Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, whatever time you're listening or wherever you're listening from. Welcome along to A Blank Canvas. I'm Cameron Rawson, and this is episode 42 with Sheldon Tarpey. How are you doing? I hope you're feeling good. This is the first episode of April. Today is April 2nd, 2021. This month, there's going to be some amazing things happening with this podcast, so please stick about. We are going video. I need to emphasize this for the new people here. So welcome along to the new folks. But also this podcast is going video from the end of this month, which means you'll be able to hear and see me talking to some wonderful people. I've got so many plans for the future and I'm really excited to share them. Going forward, my podcast is going from twice weekly to weekly, once a week, because I intend to, as I've said, to go video and to edit video, record video is stressful, and I don't want to commit to two. I want to have one episode a week, make it amazing, make the content so good that you want to watch it five times, that you learn so much, you laugh so much, you enjoy it so much. So that is coming up. That's exciting, very exciting. In the meantime, this is also exciting. In this episode, I chat with marketing strategist Sheldon Tarpey. We speak about his views on the world of marketing, the psychology and sociology of marketing, the problem and resolution, Twitter marketing, and much more. I've known Sheldon for a long while, years. We've had some great times together, great times. He's a great, intelligent, smart, funny chap. So enjoy this. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, please give us a 5-star review and hit the follow button on Spotify. So as soon as an episode is out, bam, you've got it. In the future, I'll be telling you to subscribe to our YouTube. So, you know, this is just the minimum. This is just the minimum. This is episode 41 with Sheldon Tarpey.
Welcome to A Blank Canvas with Cameron Rawson.
Sheldon, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. And I know by the end of this conversation, so many people will have many takeaways, as in not food, but, you know, like things they can help.
I get what improve. You're saying.
Yeah, you can, like, hopefully everyone else does too.
Things that they can take away.
Right. Is it more of a take home? Is that the better thing to say? A take home? I don't know.
Whatever it is, I know what you mean. It's fine. Okay. Thank you very much for having me, Cameron.
I'm looking forward to this. So let's go straight in with the question: what is it you do, and why do you enjoy it? Like,
why do I do it?
Yeah, why do you do it?
Why am I what I am? I am so. My name is Sheldon Tarpey. I am a ad strategist. I say ad strategist. So I tend to flip-flop around what I am in terms of what type of strategist. And Cameron, just as a preemptive on this, I've been in the marketing world for quite a few years now. Can you call me out if ever I say something which you think is like too like in depth or anything like that, because I feel like there's sometimes the language I use isn't stuff that I would use like to my parents, for example. So you call me out on that if ever I do it right.
Do people in the ad world have their own language as well? Do they?
Well, it's like it's any job really. So obviously you work in the music production or the audio production. There'll be job titles, for example, in there.
Abbreviations and stuff.
Yeah, exactly that kind of thing. So if ever I use that, just call me out on it and I'll explain that. So I'm just conscious that I've just used one already, that I've said I'm a strategist, but then said I'm an ad strategist, and say I don't always refer to myself as that. But I haven't even explained what a strategist is yet. So like I can't do the ad level without explaining the first bit. So I am fundamentally a marketing strategist. Currently, I work for a company called McCann. Anyone who's not familiar with the industry, hopefully this is what you need to say to friends and families, that they're like, oh, I've not heard of that. It's like, oh, just watch Mad Men, and they're mentioned on that a few times. And they're like, oh, I know Mad Men. So
you're basically Dan Draper then, right?
You know, I joke sometimes with the Mad Men joke that I'm just going to drop the shell from my name and just go by Don.
I love that.
No, I'm not Don Draper, and in many ways, and most of them hopefully good. So what is a marketing strategist, right? So when brands come to us, I mean like as an agency in general, when companies approach an agency, they will usually come with a problem, and they will say, I'm using just like, let's say, an established company at the moment. So they've been around for a while, and they want more market share, for example. They'll say, or they're launching a new product. They'll say, we're launching this product, and we want to make sure we get as many people trialing it as possible. They'll come to an agency with that. They'll probably usually go to a few agencies and try and get them all to respond to it, and then they'll pick whichever one they like the best. But the agencies will present back how they would solve that problem, whatever that is. The strategist's job in that is to provide clarity. And that is quite a vague statement, ironically, right? it's our job to give the people in creative, but often in media, the people who decide what an ad campaign should look and sound like and what it should say. We should steer them in the right direction. So we'll look at the fundamental strategy. Start with research, right? We'll look at what's out there, what's been done, what's happening in the world, at a consumer level, what are people saying, what's going on culturally, but also what's happening in the industry, that whatever the business is operating in. And we'll say, right, this is what the situation is, and this is an angle we think would work for that. Often, strategy is as much about saying what you can do or should do as it is about saying what we shouldn't do. There's a really nice saying that strategy is sacrifice. If you imagine strategy as a map, like let's start with a blank piece of paper, and there's two points, and you say, we're here, we want to be here. There's like loads of different routes that you could take to get from one point to another. Some are better. And when I say better, I mean they're like a good risk return. And some are like would take ages, and some other routes wouldn't even get there at all. So it's our job as strategists to say, this is how we get there. These are the routes that we can take, and these are the best ones to do. Often that can mean this is what your competitors are saying, but this is what they're not saying, and we could say this, and we could say it credibly. So advertising is all about standing out, right? There's a copywriter, like he's really famous, called Dave Trott. And he said in a talk I once went to that the number one point, or the first point on any advertising brief, should always be, this ad must be noticed. Because if an ad isn't noticed, then it doesn't matter what you're saying on it. It doesn't matter what product it is, what brand it is. If it's not noticed, then everything else is academic. So obviously that plays into it as well. We need to make sure that we're standing out as a brand. It's a lot easier to say than to put into practice. So it's really funny. Like, you ask people about what their experiences are with ads. And I think this is particularly true at the moment. I think there was a recent study, I can't remember who conducted it, about the least trusted professions. So like, I think advertising execs came out bottom. Like, we're the least trusted profession.
What about politicians?
We're lower than politicians.
Whoa.
Like, that's how bad it's gotten. I think a lot of that is a lot of things have changed recently. Say recently, the past few decades. I think the way people interact with ads has changed a little bit. I
Do you think that's as a result of technology as well?
I think it's driven by technology. Previously, ads, like you think about, say classic or traditional formats of out of home, which is what we would use to label billboards, or like an ad you might see at a bus stop, for example. They exist without interrupting your experience, whatever it is you're doing. And I think a lot of what we see on digital platforms at the moment can actually get in the way of what people are trying to do. I think we've always, I think anyone can relate to it, where you're on your mobile and you're trying to read a news article, and then this enormous ad comes up, and the cross for closing it is so tiny that you end up clicking it, and you're on another website.
Shit cross.
And then like you view one chair on IKEA or like any shop, and then for the next month you're getting adverts for chairs constantly. There's a lot of things which have damaged the way advertisers interact and are perceived by people, I believe. And it's our job as professionals to win back that trust and to not create ads that people hate. Like that is not something we want to do. It's what some people might want to do, for sure. But for us, it's about, you want to portray the brands you're working with in a positive light. That's what we want to achieve, because we want them to achieve growth.
So I've got a ton of follow-up questions from that, and also just a bunch of other questions. So I want to ask about you personally here. When did you realize this is something you wanted to do? Because I think it's, as much as it's not a unique career path per se, I don't think I've ever met anyone who's, not to offend you here, who's ever said when they were 15, 16, oh, I want to work in marketing, or I want to work in this kind of sector or field. So at what point did you decide you want to do that? Were you really good at the psychology aspect, the sociological aspect? Because obviously marketing is made up of so many factors, such as psychology, sociology. Yeah. We can talk about this later on. So yeah, what was the factor for you that made you want to do this?
I'm gonna reference a question to answer your question, which is I was doing a talk at a creative advertising society at a university, and one of the lecturers who was attending asked me, like, it's one of my favorite questions I've ever been asked, and he's saying that he asked, are strategists just frustrated creatives? Because the way roles in an ad agency would work, the creatives are the people who come up with the ideas of what is the ad campaign going to look like, what's actually going to happen on screen or on the billboards, and what message are we conveying, what words are we using, and the strategist doesn't write that. We would steer where that goes and the notes that needs to hit, but we don't do it. And the person who asked the question was a copywriter, so he works with words by nature. And it's quite a funny like a tip tat argument you see on social media sometimes, that strategists and creative overlap in some places, or some people say they don't. And the insight behind that question is that a lot of people will go into creative, they want to make art, and they find out they can't do that for money, because they're not famous aren't, I don't want to say talented, but like they
noteworthy, essentially.
They haven't got the reach for it for various reasons. It's a really competitive field. So a lot of people fall in that way. I think generally with marketing, there's a lot of different routes in. My route, personally, and this is how I answered the question, is that I would never say I'm a frustrated creative. I have always described myself as a frustrated psychologist. I initially wanted to do psychology at university. I didn't get the grade that I wanted to get in that A level in psychology to do it to a meaningful level at degree, where I would have been good enough. In my view, that was my opinion on it. It's psychology is one of the most popular degrees anyone can pick. So it's really competitive, and I just knew you had to be like really you had to really excel to get anywhere in that industry. But also I looked at some stats about like employability afterwards, and that was kind of a mixed bag for psychology. So I thought, right, well, my other A-levels were mathematics and economics. So marketing is a good overlap for those areas of interest. So the economics and the psychology of economics, and there's the overlap of that is behavioral economics. And then the maths analysis, which I think is good for anyone to know. So I've always described myself as a frustrated psychologist is how I got into marketing generally. I've always seen marketing as the psychology of sales, basically, is how you generate, as particularly in communications. I should specify that marketing, obviously, as you touched on earlier, covers so many things.
And that's another one. I think communications is something, and just the, especially in terms of someone like a copywriter, yeah, understanding the English language to a T is another aspect. I mean, really, marketing and everything to do with it is so, it's such an umbrella term to describe so many sub professions within marketing. It's crazy.
Yeah. There's so this is a controversial topic on what's called marketing Twitter at the moment, right? Which basically boils down to, are academic models fit for purpose anymore? If you do business studies or business A-level, you'll be taught about the four Ps of marketing. It's called the marketing mix. Those four Ps are price, product, place, promotion. And those are the four things you consider when you're in business. What is the product I'm offering? Where am I selling it? That's the place. What price point am I selling at? Is that competitive? If not, am I justifying that? And promotion, how am I talking about it in my advertising or on my website? What language am I using, etc.? But a lot of people, when they hear marketing, they just think of the promotion side. So they just, marketing and advertising, whilst to many people in the industry, they're different terms. All advertising is marketing, but not all marketing is advertising. But many people just in the public who don't work in the fields, they just think that, and they'll see an advert and they'll say, that's a nice bit of marketing. And they'll think it's exclusively that.
Sorry, I thought you were going to...
Sorry. I didn't know where I was going with that.
No, it's fair. I want to pick up on... I say pick up, you mentioned the words, social and media, and it's a very fascinating platform. I mean, the whole online world is ever changing. So I imagine that's also quite, not intimidating, but a lot of hard work for someone like yourself or a company in which you work for, because you have to evolve just as fast as technology evolves to take full advantage of the market and how to advertise within it. But more importantly, what I want to talk about is things on social media. I say things, accounts on social media for brands. You've always got massive brands. They have social media accounts, and they have people behind these social media accounts. Now, what I always find fascinating is how they're so important. Twitter accounts, brand accounts, the voices of these brands. Is that marketing? Does that fall within the marketing bubble, or is that a social media manager and that's got nothing to do with marketing?
So to answer the last part of that question, social media is marketing. Whatever you're using it for is marketing. Marketing is how you operate as a business. So are you market oriented? So what you just touched on there. Brands that have a huge social presence, that have a huge following. I don't know if you had any that came to mind, but that they would be using those platforms for their promotion side. But also many brands, and I think probably the most useful thing that brands can use social media for is customer service, right? Like, it's very rare, or it used to be very rare prior to social media. If someone had an issue with your product, they would talk about that amongst their friends privately, like verbally or through text or whatever. But now that's in public, that's in the public domain. If you're on a site like Twitter and someone has a bad experience, they might tweet about it. And if it's a public account, you as a brand can see it and you can respond to it. That's a huge opportunity for brands to turn bad experiences into a good one, or at least a resolved one. So at the same time, there's a lot of discussion again about what I'm going to call organic social on that. And I'll explain what I mean by that. And organic social is where brands simply use their social media account as if it were I don't want to say as if it were a person, but it's basically they don't put money behind what they're saying. We'll use Twitter as an example again. They will tweet things out and they will just leave them. They won't put money behind them. And that is something called organic. And I think a problem a lot of brands have with organic is it's seen as something that's free to do because you don't have any media costs associated with it. The problem with that is that it's not. It is not free at all. There is an enormous amount of resource that's dedicated to putting organic content out, whether that's actually writing what goes on, creating the images, to getting the sign off, to then, you have to hire people to do all these jobs. So it is not a free expense. And
so can I ask? Yeah. For example, there's obviously the big thing of, I think it was Weetabix and Heinz was a massive sort of situation a few weeks ago in which countries' Twitter accounts were getting involved. Police forces, everything it was insane. Now, was that? Do you think something like that was calculated over weeks, months of planning? Was that an overnight thing? Tell me, do you have any idea of how much would have gone into something like that?
I have no knowledge of what happened the thing you're referring to is Weetabix. I'm assuming is Weetabix put out an image of how they eat how people could eat their Weetabix, which is instead of milk they use beans, right?
Which is disgusting.
Yeah, it's part of a it. To answer your question, was it calculated? Yes, absolutely. It was calculated by. There'll be some social media team somewhere that said their goal would be to create engagement on the platform of Twitter, which that was posted on. And a good way of doing that is by, and I'm quoting, I think it's a YouTube account called Yes Theory, is they offend the internet. If you offend the internet, they will let you know.
Big up Yes Theory, big fan of that channel.
So a reference to the Yes Theory video I'm talking about is they offended the internet by creating a fake image of what looked like Justin Bieber eating a burrito sideways.
Yes, that's right.
And it was a lookalike who, to be fair, it does look like him. But their brief to themselves was, how do we offend the internet and get a video to go viral? And they got like national news coverage. The way that tweet went down for Weetabix, and I'm purely hypothesizing here, is that I think if you're in their social media team, you can only see that as a success. Like, of course you see that as a success. What I would question, however, is the value that generates for you as a brand. There's, as I said before, that is seen as something that was probably created at very low cost, when that's probably not the case. But there will be, I assume, agencies behind that that content. Many, many people signing that off that would have cost a lot of money for reach, which it probably was seen by quite a lot of people who are in touch with the marketing world, and I would include yourself in that take an interest in brands on social media. But many people that don't fit into that demographic probably didn't see it. I would encourage you to ask your parents if they know anything about it.
So can I just give you my take on what I think, where I think you're going with this, and also
sure.
What I think about the idea is, you raise a very good point of value, because really, is anybody going to go out and buy more Weetabix as a result? Because that's the whole idea, isn't it? Is that they want to sell more product. So are people going to go rush out to Sainsbury's or whatever to go buy a bunch of boxes of Weetabix because of this advert? I mean, really, for me, it put me off eating Weetabix, which is ironic, because as much as that they have this shock value, pardon me, as much as they have this shock value, I think it's done a it's done me dirty in a way of wrong phrase, but what I'm getting at is that I've no desire to eat Weetabix anymore. I mean, I did like Weetabix, but it wasn't something I was never like a huge Weetabix fan. Strange conversation we're having, I must say. But it's something which, having seen a photo of beans on Weetabix, whenever I go to eat Weetabix again, if I do, I'm going to be put off by them because of this saga. So whilst obviously it's been great for them, I'm speaking just for myself here, but I imagine it's probably the same for a few people. So the idea of the value is that, yeah, they've created all this engagement, but has it sold more Weetabix off the shelf? Which is one question. And yeah,
so that is one question. That is the marketing question, which everything promotional that you do, I say promotional, like outward communicating, ultimately the people making those images and their bosses, they will have targets to hit. And those targets always boil down to how many are we selling, how much revenue and profit are we generating? That is the company KPI. And I would assume that is the case for Weetabix. I don't know. I don't have the stat in front of me. I didn't know we were going to be talking about Weetabix, but there was an article at the time when that happened about there was a shop which put a sale on. A point they literally, I think they changed the shelf that Weetabix was on. They moved everything up. I'd encourage listeners to go and look at what actually happened in this, because I'm probably not doing it justice. But and they saw a massive increase in sales, and people attributed this to this Weetabix tweet, which had gone viral. But really, there's no way of separating. What if you just moved that shelf anyway? Would you have then just sold more because you're at eye level or something? But obviously, even then, like getting a shelf moved at a shop level is quite a small change to make. Whereas, I mean, just talking about the Weetabix tweet, but also every brand that replied to that, and every verified account, you talk about countries and stuff replying to it. There's a lot of effort and money that goes behind these, organic tweets that people think are really, really great and creative. And as I said earlier, like does it create more value? I'm not so sure. I haven't seen the evidence to suggest that. And there's always a really kind of similar case study. People use, say similar, didn't offend the internet, but I don't know if you remember the Super Bowl a few years ago. Probably about 6 or 7 years ago, I think it was, when there was a blackout, there was a power cut.
I don't remember that, to be fair.
I don't remember that happening. I think the power went out for about half an hour during the game. And Oreo tweeted out a picture where you can just see a really faint piece of the Oreo, but you can see the full white filling, right? And it was like, you can still dunk in the dark, was the caption. And everyone, especially in marketing, advertising, Twitter, really like praised this and heaped praise on it. And I probably did that at the time, but it was a great move. But the marketing director, I believe it was the marketing director who worked on that at the time, came out afterwards and said that the amount of reach that they gained from that actually cost them so much money, just because of the amount of people they had working on it, the amount of people they had working in the room creating reactive content, could have easily have been done just by running a campaign with a similar amount of budget.
What I find interesting is the amount of people that are involved in something that the outside world would see as being a man and his dog sat in a room just thrown together. I don't know if it's like, I don't know whether it's like that's an insult or what to, because it's not intended that way. But for example, again, just to, we'll ease the topic of conversation from Weetabix after this, but that sort of campaign, or whatever you want to call it, campaign for sure, the amount of people involved with that will have been, I imagine, in the double figures, right?
I don't know. I imagine so. Yeah.
But either way, it wasn't. I can't imagine it was just one person.
No. So highly unlikely. There's So that as soon as you have multiple people, like there's a phrase when people say, "Oh, this is an expensive meeting." When you have a lot of people in the room, because like it's a lot of people's time going into something, and those people's time is not free resource. When you have people working on one project, that is costing them working on another project, for example. I think what people often see are these Weetabix moments or these Oreo moments of virality. That I say virality, I think it's maybe even giving them a lot of credit. There's there's so many brands that try and do that and fail, but your chance of success
is there a certain level of luck involved in it then?
So much. I'd say it's almost entirely luck. There will be obviously we use the Weetabix example. They've got a big audience to start with. But you never hear about the attempts that fail. Obviously, sure, you don't, yeah. Because they don't get the coverage. And really, like if I asked you or you asked me to replicate that, that is almost an impossible task for many, many brands to do, because you need the right moment and the right timings and the right people to see it. And a lot of those things you just can't predict, particularly once it's been done already. That, like, for example, if another brand tried the Weetabix thing or something similar, like I don't know a brand, but let's say they just put beans on whatever it is they sell, they put beans on it. That wouldn't have the same impact now. It's a really hard, it's so difficult that it's almost not worth the risk. When I say the risk, I mean the financial risk of putting that much time and effort of your people into it, when they could be doing other things which you know are more likely to generate reach and sales.
Would you say, going away from this topic, would you say influencers are marketing geniuses or genii? I don't know what the plural is. Genius is just, I don't know. Either way, would you say that the influencer today is a genius when it's down to marketing?
Genius is... I don't really like the word genius, just because, like, and I say this just because in marketing we as the collective, as an industry, there's a bit of a trope at the moment that in many job descriptions people will say we're looking for a marketing guru or a ninja or a marketing rock star.
I hate that. Like, I've seen that.
If I can rephrase your question, are they very talented marketers? Why not? I think, you know, selling yourself is one thing, and that's selling yourself I don't want to say easier, because obviously there's many people that try and be influencers that aren't. But I would also challenge the notion of influencers. We have always had influencers in many ways. There have always been experts in certain fields that have earned their rights to be there through their work that they do. What we've seen social media, like Instagram and Twitter, do is been a democratization of that to a degree. It is easier to generate a following because you don't need to win over the people that would control the media spaces. And it's a similar thing to what you see in music as well. Our musicians that get big through YouTube marketing geniuses. You know, if we go back to the four P's,
could we not use the word genius, please?
Yeah, sorry. Are musicians, for example, who get big through YouTube. Fundamentally, you have to have something that people want to consume. They want to buy with their time. Obviously, it's free now. That's how they pay for it. That is the fundamental of it. You have to be a good creative. So there are bands that get really big through YouTube these days that, you know, 20 years ago when YouTube wasn't a thing. I say it wasn't a thing, it was 2001. I don't think it was a thing then. But that wouldn't have been possible then, because you're at the mercy of people who control the radio stations. So, you go back to your original question. Are they talented?
Well, sorry, just to carry on with this, in your humble opinion, would you say, I don't know why I said humble there, but in your opinion here, would you say that in terms of music, you're not obviously within the music industry itself, but a lot of it, would you say a lot of it is someone's success is down to marketing? I have this conversation with musicians. So I'm curious on asking you from the marketing side, as opposed to the musician side, do you think nowadays for an artist to be successful, whether it's a musician, singer, even anyone within the creative industry, comedian, magician, anyone trying to make a name for themselves, do you think in the climate today, obviously 30 years ago, you had to sell yourself still in terms of marketing, but now do you think it's quite influential as to how influential you are?
Fundamentally, when it comes down to entertainment, which is what all those people you just listed, musicians, comedians, etc., you have to have a good product to sell. You can go viral all you want, you can put beans on your Weetabix all you want. If you're a comedian, and it's probably a bad idea because that actually was quite funny. If you're a musician doing something like that and your music's terrible, that's not going to help you much. So fundamentally, it's a good way of sharing your talent. Like if you can know the platforms that are free for you to use, so like Twitter, go back a few years, Tumblr, bands could get big on. That will help you out for sure. But ultimately, it boils down to do you have a good product worth selling? And I'm going to point you in the direction of a band called The Sherlocks.
I've heard of them,
familiar with them?
I
heard of them before. I met them once in Lincoln. They were I was working on a podcast that I used to do, and they came into the green room whilst we were interviewing someone. I think we were interviewing Arcane Roots, but the Sherlocks went viral within their like indie music sphere because they were on a festival lineup. And they had moved themselves up the festival lineup, so they had swapped themselves around with another band, and like I think they played it off as being like a tongue-in-cheek joke. I'm not entirely sure that was the case, but their music did not have the appeal as a band like the Night Cafe, who were a similar size at the time but are now much bigger. But they got that exposure, but it didn't generate the repeat business. I'm sure after seeing that, many people probably listened to the Sherlocks, but didn't return as customers. I kind of hate the word customers in that context because, you know, you're consuming.
Yeah,
that
you are
artist's
essentially
work, right?
Solara. You are, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So, the original topic, like, are they good marketers? Like, yes, but. Like part of being a good marketer is having a good product, and you know I can't remember who said it, so someone might have to help me out with the quote. But if you promote a really shit product really well, you'll generate one sale because people will try it once and then never try again because they're like, that was terrible, good ad, but I'm not doing that again, that was bad. So you have to be good at everything, and that's like, it's not good advice, but when you talk about musicians, you have to make music that people want to listen to. Fundamentally, that has to be true.
It's a very, I don't even know how to phrase what I'm about to say here, but I feel like it's very difficult for people in the entertainment industry to, in quotation marks, make it now, because whilst it is easy in the sense that there's all these social media platforms, TikTok, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and alike, to promote your product yourself, there's also a ton of other people doing the exact same thing. So would you say it's now, even coming from a professional angle like yourself, do you think it's harder than ever to create a, in quotation marks, a successful campaign because there's so many people who are trying to do successful campaigns, whether it's a man in his room, or a woman, whatever, in his room, an individual in the room? Do you think there's a lot of competition now because it's so easy to...
There is undoubtedly a lot of competition. That is visibly true. Anyone can be on Spotify if they pay the price that Spotify want. I don't know how that works, but as an artist. But I think that the overall conversation, is it harder? I don't believe it is harder, no. For musicians, we're talking about musicians specifically here, but I think I'd say the same is probably the same for like if you're a comedian on TikTok. The barriers are lower now than they were 20 years ago. 20 years ago, to make it as a comedian, you'd have had to do the rounds on the small club circuit, hope that the right person comes to your show, sees you on a good day, books you as a support or an opening act for a bigger comedian, and you get their audience. Whereas now, just as an example that's come to the top of my head, Jonathan Pye, right, who does, he's, for listeners who aren't aware, he's a fake news reporter. Cameron, do you think that's fair? Fake news reporter?
I'd say it's more like, yeah, fake news. Well, it's like a parody take, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is it, that's the right word?
Yeah, I think he's a parody of a news reporter that ends up going on a rant at the end of every video. He started with a YouTube channel, and now he's doing it like massive venue tours. You know, that is something that wasn't previously possible. That is something that a man in their room or someone, a kid in their room, could do with music. So, you know, there is competition. Yeah, there's a staggering amount of competition, but it is fundamentally easier to make it further with fewer resources now than it was previously. If you have the money, the capital, and the equipment, if you're a musician, obviously you've got the advantage. But the barriers for entry are now lower. And I think we talk about specific channels, for example. There's a lot of value to being first on a channel or early in the channel life cycle, like before they get adopted by a large group of people, because that's when you can start getting a really engaged audience. There's like the tech adoption curve of like early adopters, and then you get the laggards at the end.
So someone that was first on TikTok, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. You see the people that that were first on TikTok to gain a big follower, that grows and it compounds as time goes on. Because you get new people coming on, they look at the most, I think, who's the most followed person on TikTok? Is it Charlie D'Amelio or something?
Yeah, Charlie and Dixie D'Amelio.
Yeah, like that is born out of them being on the platform early. Like that, if they join now, I would, you know, we don't know this for certain, but if they never joined and they join now, it would be far, far harder for them to do that. And so what we see is a lot of, I want to use the term creatives, people who make things. They get an advantage by being on platforms early if it fits with them. If that makes sense. And you know, that's why I'm not a huge fan of Gary Vee's work, but he always just downloads whatever is like the up and coming social app, and a lot of them fail. Like a lot of do you remember when Periscope was a thing, and then Meerkat was the competitor app?
I think Casey Neistat made his own social media platform, which failed as well.
Yeah, exactly. Like there's so many things that fail that people that get on the ones that succeed, they ride the success of the platform as well. And I think that's what we've seen with creatives on TikTok. I just rambled a bit there. But.
No. I asked the question, and I appreciate your reply, your humble opinion on this. I want to ask a few more questions, but one of them is very, I guess it's $1 million question, and that is, what makes a great campaign?
Results. Results make a great campaign.
So it literally is just what... So I guess results is very vague, though. Does it depend on the company, the campaign, what they're wanting to achieve?
Yeah, so... the start of any campaign is clear objectives, right? You say, what are we trying to achieve? That could be sell more of X product or Y product. It could be make people know we exist, which eventually turns into sales. But what makes a great campaign? You can only determine what's great when you measure something. Like the quality of something is always measured. Like with diamonds, for example, you'd have a brilliant diamond. Which is the adjective that industry uses. But that's a grading scale. And fundamentally for me, you should look at what your objectives were, what the results you set out to achieve were, and have you succeeded with those? And obviously that would then be reflected in the business growth as well. So there's a really nice saying. I saw Nils Leonard share it. I don't know if it's him that said it originally, but advertising is art that sells. If advertising doesn't sell, then it's just art.
That's very, I like that. I like that a lot. It's very apt. Who out there, and in terms of personal brand to yourself, is like, wow, they've got it on lock. They have it on lock. Is there any individual out there where you're just like, damn? And also another thing on top of that, I mean, obviously people like influencers probably do, but in terms of individuals, do you think a lot of people will have, I mean, okay, I know Stephen Bartlett, for example, from Social Chain.
Social Chain, yeah.
He has or had, I imagine he still does, have a personal, like an individual who works on his personal brand, or probably has at this point a few because of the amount of money he has behind him. So do you think that's a common thing where a lot of people will potentially have an individual, a couple of people, a team working on that individual's brand as if it's a company? And yeah, also going back to the root question is, do you think there's anybody out there whose brand is just so good that you're like, wow, they've got it unlocked?
I mean, so having a personal brand is like, and even the term personal brand is a bit like contentious with a lot of people. Right. Like, you're commoditizing yourself. And a lot of people in the industry don't see that as a positive thing. It's seen as part of like hustle culture, where like you just always work or whatever. You don't like spend time doing whatever you want to do. Or you know, for me, I think personal brands are a good thing if you want to invest in that. If you I think it's really good for someone to see your, it sounds so like reductive now, but personal brand is about someone seeing your name next to something and knowing that it's going to be of a certain quality, because that's just what brands are. You're applying the thoughts of regular brands, which is like, as you go back to when people used to make armor and smelt iron, and they would brand their logo into it, or make leather and they would brand their logo into it, because you know it's of a certain quality with that branding.
Right.
Yeah, it's where the word brand comes from. You brand something.
Oh, shit. Wow. Okay.
So it's a marker. A brand is a marker of quality, or agreed quality. That's why people do personal branding, is that they want their name to be synonymous with something of, I would assume, high quality, unless they've got another angle to it, for example. We touched on Gary Vee earlier, and I'm not a big fan of a lot of what he says or
why
what
is that
he does.
Out of interest?
Because I think he fuels, or he has fueled, and I haven't seen his recent a lot of his recent content. I don't really follow it anymore, so this might be out of date. But he's previously fueled hustle culture a lot, in terms of you should be working all the time, every second of every day. And it's just, for a lot of people, that I think that's bad advice. If you want to do what Gary does, then yeah, fine, do that. But really, people should do what is right for them. Like, a lot of people, like if you want to succeed to the level that a CEO does, then you have to put in the work. But a lot of people don't want that trade-off. They want more life outside of work. That's just my take on what he says. I don't think it's. I think it's kind of unhealthy in that way. But either way, on the note of personal branding, even if I'm not a huge fan, I think it would be wrong of me to say that he hasn't developed a strong personal brand. You know, he's known within his circles of followers as someone who produces a type of content to a certain quality. I think he's produced three or four books, maybe even. But you asked earlier about, do people have teams? I don't think he's written either of those. I think he's quite openly had them ghostwritten. So, but he's put his own brand on it as a way of saying. I think he even says in some of his interviews that he's ghostwritten. You might need to fact check me on that, but I'm sure he said it and he's been open with it. that it's almost like transcribed in that way. So yeah, there's absolutely people with teams, as Steve Bartlett did have like a team of videographers follow him around.
Sheldon, it's been really good talking to you. I've enjoyed this conversation.
So much
covered. But before I let you go, I ask every single guest the same question at the end of I ask every single guest this same question at the end of every single episode. And that is, if I gave you a blank canvas, what would you paint on it and why?
What colour is the canvas? Is it just white, like blank canvas?
You know what? It's open to interpretation. However, okay. whatever colour you want the canvas to be.
Whatever you said in terms of whatever colour it is, I would say I'm painting it that exact colour. I'm leaving it exactly as it is because I like things that are open to interpretation. It's whatever you want it to be. So I want my blank canvas to remain blank.
You are a closed book, and also and also very clever in the sense of you just are, aren't you?
So. No, I disagree with that, but I'm glad you think so.
Sheldon, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks so much for having me on, Cameron.
Thank you for listening to this episode of A Blank Canvas. You can follow us on Instagram at A Blank Canvas Pod, or you can like us on Facebook / A Blank Canvas Pod. If you want to contact us for any reason, it's hello@ablankcanvaspod.com or visit our website, ablankcanvaspod.com.